and we have wide-ranging discussions. But it's often about this area we're talking about tonight. Okay. It's often about that because it's inspiring. You know, ethics are inspiring, but sadhana is very inspiring for me. If you think of Dasani referred to the gravitational pull of the transcendental object, the gravitational pull of unconditioned versus us, our escaping our own small, slightly seedy yuckiness, whatever. And as you get closer and closer and closer, the pull becomes greater because you're getting closer to that. So you're more available to the pull of the unconditioned, or whatever you call it. Now, tonight we're in the land of metaphor, okay? And none of it is literal. Okay, none of it is literal. Everything is fingers pointing at the moon. Alright? Today I was helping one of my students solve double integration and do some finite element analysis of something. Maths. Very clear, very creative, but using a very different side of my brain and my, you know, it's just a different thing. Still had to relate to the lad as a human being, which I hope I did. Yeah. So, in this Dharma life, we know what we've got, the five great stages. Don't need to say too much about integration and positive emotion, except they're very important, and especially positive emotion in this area. Okay, Bhante considers that metta itself is a insight practice, is a spiritual death practice. Okay, and I've got a wee quote from Bhante, and he says, "A common misapprehension is to think of insight and egolessness in the abstract, even metaphysical terms, rather than comprising concretely lived attitudes and behaviour. But realising the truth of egolessness simply means being truly and deeply unselfish. To contemplate the principle of egolessness as some special principle that is somehow separate from our actual behaviour, we'll leave it as far away as ever. If we find it difficult to realise the ultimate emptiness of the self, the solution is to try and be a little less selfish. The understanding comes after the experience." The understanding comes after the experience. Now, that's my experience. Tell you a little about my practice life. I have inherited either the Citta Dharma or the Mano Niyama. You know, the kind of your mind and your conditioning that makes you what you are in a way, but it's not to do with choice. Of a very sparky mind and not a very attentive mind. Okay? Slightly bonkers of mind. Okay? So, although I do and always have enjoyed concentration practices, I don't, and managed to enjoy the jhana factors, I'm sure, that practice is not always that satisfying for me. Okay? So I've got that to work with. Okay. After I was ordained, I went through a 6 months period of the doldrums, the dharmic doldrums. Okay. And there I was, not really knowing what was happening. And it was decidedly unpleasant. And I thought, what's going to do? So I decided on action. I exploited the Karma Niyama. And I phoned up Dhanakosha and invited myself on a retreat there. And Pasadena was on that very retreat. And it was the first time I met her, and she was sitting up there. And I thought she was very wise. Right? And there she was, teaching beautifully on the retreat. So was Nayaka. And the theme was the Four Noble Truths. And that's a very fundamental, basic teaching in the Buddha's Dharma, isn't it? The Four Noble Truths. And we don't hear a huge amount about that particular formulation of conditionality in Tiratna. But I was very happy to hear it. And it was a lovely, great week. And I went through the mill. I also had the opportunity to decorate the shrine. And I went to town. Normally I don't do that, what I call evolution shrine stuff. Remember, evolution was the shops we used to have that sold fluffy toys and soft goods and canned incense burners. So I was doing the shrine. The shrine got more and more mental, as did my mind, and it was fabulous, right? Because then I started to practice my sadhana practice. The sadhana practice came alive. My sadhana is the glorious Avalokiteshvara, okay, white in colour. Probably most of you know, but this is the Bodhisattva of compassion, great compassion. So there I was in the company of Avalokiteshvara. And not only in the company of Avalokiteshvara, I was in the company of Amitabha. Because in that particular practice, they come together. And Amitabha was providing blessings. And in the practice, one self-visualizes. You put on a suit, imaginatively. And you redistribute the blessings to the realms in the form of the mantra. Now, that sounds quite mechanistic, but it's not mechanistic. Okay? The practice of the sadhana is quite subtle in a way, but it's not a mystery in many ways, except for one big way. Why is it that Avalokiteshvara becomes as if real? Why is that? Why is a relationship formed with that Yidam? Why is that satisfying? And what on earth has it got to do with the Buddha's Dharma? You ever thought that? It's a good question, though. It's a good question. Now, I think compassion is something to do with wisdom, perhaps. And the Buddha's Dharma is about wisdom. But it's a type of wisdom that's warm, big. It's not a dissecting wisdom. It's not a cold cutting thing. The thing that got me most about this practice was beauty. I couldn't believe how beautiful this was. I just couldn't get it. It blew me away. Now, that's the kind of character I am. I do extremes in discussion. But the beauty is very, very important. There's something about the beauty, almost erotic. Okay, the beautiful figure, absolutely glorious. Without going into detail, there's something about that that's immensely satisfying. Okay. And I suppose I'll maybe go to my notes at one point because I haven't used them. Oh yes. I suppose where I'm getting to is that imagining the Buddha is opening up to the influence of the Dharma Niyama. Now, the Dharma Niyama, I really don't know what that is. It's something suprapersonal, as far as I know, but I know I partake of it in some sense, but it's beyond me. Now, I'm making no claims to have a connection with the Buddha. I'm not. I'm just saying that there are glimpses in our experience of the transcendental object. There has to be. You wouldn't be sitting here if there wasn't. If there wasn't a sense that there is a fulfillment, you wouldn't be sitting here. Okay. So Dharma practice in sadhana is more about moving towards than away. It's a very positive state of affairs. Okay. Very positive. Now, this week talks evolved. And at first we were going to talk about an insight. So I want to say a little bit inside. Now, I don't know you all that well, but one of the stages in sadhana, I'll tell you that roughly just to give you context what the stages are. Okay. The stages in sadhana are, first of all, you sit in your bum and you get yourself collected. You get into the frame of mind of meditation. And normally, the way I would do that is in a metta, a well-wishing, just to get the heart more pliable, okay, settling down. And that can take a while, obviously. And then I go for refuge. And when I go for refuge, I kind of make an acknowledgement about false refuge. The things that I'm not needing to refuge in, the things that have let me down, I acknowledge that. So I go for my refuge. And I can do that formally or just the way I've done it there just now. I can think about, you know, all the things that I take refuge in that are actually not the Dharma life. Just acknowledge that. And I may repeat my precepts and the refuge verses. The context is not that important, I don't think. And then I do reflections on emptiness, shunyata reflections. And I usually, for old time's sake, really, I used to practice in a much simpler school of Buddhism, and I just used the old Pali formulation, which you'll all know, is sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe sankhara dukkha, and sabbe dhamma anatta. That is just very, very important. So I reflect on that. And then I repeat a mantra, and it's called the emptiness mantra, and this mantra resonates for me. And Subhuti says that we should charge our mantras. We should charge them up. We should anchor our mantras in something cognitive as well as emotional. I was in retreat a long time ago and I had a very bad retreat. He's laughing. He knows what's coming, you know. But all through this retreat was formative, I tell you, but I didn't like it. We chanted this mantra twice a day for hours. And I was so tired of chanting this mantra, so the emptiness mantra took on a thing there, and it was a very powerful retreat that stayed with me, tell you. And any time I do element practice or anatta reflection, because I do quite a lot of anatta reflections in my practice, any time I do that, I bring the mantra to mind, and I think I call that charging the mantra. So the mantra now becomes an icon for this concept. So I do that. I remind myself of the emptiness, and I'll say, and then the thoughts will come, who is doing the practice? Who's doing this practice? Who's asking that question? Is that just a thought? Is that a passing thought I'm having? So I point again a few times at my own experience to say, what is this? And that obviously leads nowhere. That reflection leads nowhere except an opening in the mind. However small, there will be an opening. If you look for yourself, you will open. Or you look for the I, even better, use grammar. You look for the I. What am I? Who is this? Who's sitting here? Who's listening to the traffic? Or is there just listening? Or is there just the sensations arising? The thoughts just arising? So I do anatta reflections in the sadhana beforehand. And that can take quite a while. Or not. So after doing that, the practices almost all universally have got a symbol that we share together called the blue sky. You know the blue of the Dharma we see in the kesas? The blue sky. The emptiness of the blue sky. And if you look at a blue sky, really lovely blue sky, it doesn't seem to begin, does it? And it doesn't seem to end. There's no depth to it. Is it really deep or is it not? You know, I just don't know what blue sky is. So the blue sky takes on this, and I suppose... the idea of the blue sky is it's quivering, it's energetic, it's blazing with energy and openness. It's got potential. It hasn't taken a position. You know what I mean? It hasn't decided it's right or it's wrong. It hasn't decided it's up or down. It hasn't taken a position. That's the freedom, isn't it? Not to take a position. Not to take the position. The trackless one. You know the Buddha, the trackless one. So the blue sky again is a great place to be on its own. And I've written down here, I'll read it to you. The blue sky, this is an idea, a metaphor, or an image for shunyata, the open dimension beyond subjective construction. Okay. Beyond subjective construction. Words and concepts, which is the way all things actually are. The way that all things actually are. So it's not just the I that's empty. It's not just this thought. This Maitrinaga thing. That's not just emptiness. It's everything else. Everything else. So that's the reflection. So it's not philosophizing at this stage. It's just blue sky. Blue sky. And then what happens? Sometimes with will, sometimes not with will. This is where I'm learning the practice. Sometimes Avalokiteshvara is developed in that blue sky. Okay. On a very good day, maybe on retreat, that happens on its own. But generally, it just happens because that's the practice. Avalokiteshvara appears. Great beauty of Avalokiteshvara. And the whole thing about that appearance is wisdom. The whole practice is pointing to the wisdom that we may have remembered in the Heart Sutra. Okay. And it points to this idea that appearance itself, the appearance of Avalokiteshvara, or me as Avalokiteshvara, appearance itself is emptiness, and emptiness itself is appearance. This appearance is not other than emptiness, and emptiness is not other than appearance. So what's that all about? But it's still there, but it's empty. Okay, so we have this lovely position, and the word, sometimes when you're studying this, it's called the Maya way. Some of the guys will have studied this at a weekend. We call it the Maya way. And you know that the word Maya means illusion. I only knew it from Hinduism before, but Maya is illusion. So this is the way of illusion. It is the magic show that we read about in the Prajnaparamita. It is, I looked for the quote from Bhante at home, but I didn't have the book. But the one I got was an approximation. Do you know the one at the beginning of Wisdom Beyond Words? It says, like stars, blurred vision, lamps, illusions, dew, bubbles, dreams, lightning and clouds, thus conditioned phenomena are to be. So it's a trick or an illusion, it's a magician's show. There's a great word that Bhante uses called diaphanous, which always makes me think of terrine curtains. But diaphanous is that when you're visualizing, when the visualizing is happening, it doesn't have to be Disney. It doesn't have to be colored and bright. And I understand some people do that. It can be due to atmosphere and feeling, and also the mantra is the same as a visualization. The mantra is part of this Maya way. It's a trick, a show, it's empty. And it's the mantra of Avalokiteshvara. Okay, I'm moving on. Last thing I want to say is the idea of devotion at this stage. In the middle of this practice, my devotion would be toward Amitabha, because I am self-visualizing as Avalokiteshvara. So Amitabha, I presume this transcendental devotion helps develop the idea that behind every image there is a greater truth. By encountering it in more and more vividly and more fully, it becomes transcendental, or transcendentalized, I think it said here. Okay. So that's my little bit about sadhana. There's loads and loads we can talk about there. But I think we'll be maybe talking a bit later about why are these guys talking about sadhana to me? What does it mean? You know, how does that affect you? Because, you know, we hear you get sadhana practice or on ordination, and we'll be exploring and rambling around that a wee bit later. Okay. So I have gone completely off script tonight, so I hope it was slightly coherent for you. To be taken by surprise by the beauty. Alright? So he's now going to talk about his, aren't you?
Okay. Yeah, I love the conversations that are built up in our chapter. And we've got both these charging butterfly minds, and some of the rest of the chapter just think a bit differently. So they're kind of going, oh, at the end of it now. So charging around. And that was quite fascinating. We've come in from different angles into our sadhana, mm-hmm. and got a lot in common.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like your family religion was Marxism and mine was Presbyterianism. And you know, and you've got this Korean science, and
mm-hmm.
I've got the arts and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, which is quite fascinating. I suppose there's a thing, there's also the love of opera and show,
mm-hmm.
and beauty,
mm-hmm.
above all, isn't it? Will I blather about mine?
Yes.
I remember my ordination all these years ago. At my private ordination, I was given just the bones of the sadhana, the mantra, and then it built up, you know, with various help from people. But I was introduced to that. And for the first time, meditation made sense. So this is my personal angle. It kind of, everything pulled together, and it's what my thing has been talking about, but this system of practice, it's clear now, but the aspects are sort of brought out, but it's all been there way back, even 24 years ago. So it was like, where are we? Spiritual rebirth, all the others were present. You know, I've done a month of doing the six element practice beforehand, and I've done years of having to sit down and do the mindfulness of breathing, though I was very reluctant, you know, other people made me do it, you know, and do the metta-bhavana and really socially with other people, all these positive things as a building. But the sadhana was suddenly, that made sense for me of meditation. I remember being at school, I was just down with my family there at a funeral, family funeral, and you think about yourself and where you come from and where you grow up. And there was a conversation with my sister, whose son is nowadays he's diagnosed with Asperger's. It's on the diagnosis now in special support, but we're also amazed how similar we were. And we both of us when in the maths class would come up with the answer and then just be really impatient at having to work out the stuff in between. The teacher wants to see the workings. It's like, there's your answer, what are you wanting? You know, the boring of that. So it's kind of like the sadness is like, I want the answer, and to hell with all the sums and workings in between. So that was quite a bit temperament. And similar in a way, what you were saying, slightly different angle, you've got more patience and energy for mindfulness and more interest in it, but I get bored by it. One of my best pictures I've done in the last year was when Dastien was leading us through a body awareness during, we didn't have to lie down for goodness sake, and do this body awareness, and there's my toes here, I know that they're there, yeah. And then like going, oh, this, and then this shape, and then this is going to be so good, yeah. And then at the break running out and drawing it down. Yeah, there's a weekend here with Damarati, a men's going for every weekend, and he did the whole thing on the Satipatthana Sutta, and I know it's good for me, and I know the benefits from it, and I feel better afterwards. It's like brushing my teeth. But I don't want to spend a whole weekend talking about brushing my teeth. Yeah, someone's saying you should brush your teeth, it's good for you. I go, yeah, great, and yes, it's great, I feel fresher afterwards, but spend a whole weekend on it. Another thing, the modern insight practices and different things that go really bore me. A lot of my friends who I trust and respect their practice get into it, and I go, maybe I should. So I even buy the book, and I'm going, you know, or things online by order members, and it's like, I go, that looks a good bit. There's a Lakshana's. I have a quote there, and then a quote here from, well, that's Mahayana as well. It's interesting, Palika and Mahayana. And I sit down to read it and go, no, I get bored. So the sadness somehow catches me. Yeah, there's something about what you were saying, you were going to quite elegantly into the form and emptiness. That is something that's caught me, appearance emptiness, and what Maitra Nagar was talking about with the blue sky and the form, and it's the same stuff. One of the uniquenesses of Buddhist practice and philosophy is distinct from a lot of religions, is one isn't underneath or prior or more real than the other. The union of form and emptiness and the union of wisdom and compassion and practice, that is crucial to the distinctiveness of Buddhist thought. We'll probably come back to that. What got me about that was that I'd known this since I took magic mushrooms out in the hills in Arran at the age of 18, when mostly signs and labels and fixtures of things just got out of the way, and there was this just dynamic flow of everything. Even flow is ridiculous. You just laugh at flow if you're on magic mushrooms, sometimes even mushrooms. And there it was, everything was simultaneously there and not there. That's the best sense I made at the time. Like if I took a photograph of you're sitting here, and then you went, it was on tripod, the camera, and you left the room and took another photograph and then superimposed the two, being a computer nowadays, wouldn't it? And you would be kind of there and not there. And everything is like that. Yeah. So that fascinated me, just this neither is nor isn't. And being really frustrated with people stuck within one literal frame. My friend Sarvananda, a writer who's not here giving talks, he's written a few books. He writes plays for radio and all of that. And he, we often meet up in Norwich on the way to or from Handelokan. And just big streams of conversations fueled by caffeine and coffee, and decent coffee. And he was talking about one of our films we both love, Fanny and Alexander, Ingmar Bergman, where you have a theatre family, and these children grow up in the theatre family, and then they end up in this bishop's family, and he's puritanical. And the contrast to the house from the rich, opulent, what would be in this country, in these islands, Victorian, you know, just over the top, with ghosts and things moving about, magical things moving about, and totally over the top, emotional characters having affairs with everybody in this big theatre bunch, to this austere, ugly, minimalist space with these ugly family members. And the bishop saying, try and explain to the son who has to move there because the wife loses the first husband, the theatre family, and marries, is getting more involved. meet it. Involved with, gets married to the bishop and moves there, and the boy's just not conforming to this new way of life, and saying, you know, the bishop's been quite open and confessional and sharing his struggles and things and a way to quite win him round, and saying, I only have one mask and I can't get it off. I can't manage to take it off. Whereas the theatre folk, they were flying all the time. So it's a bit like kind of just this, you see through the labels of things, you see through the fixedness of things, and you see the dynamic shifting of things, and things being, as it were, both there and not there. I mean, the good thing about, that's maybe what led me to Buddhism, was like, what the hell is real? When coming across Sangha, actually talking about insubstantiality, about the leaf changing colour, and leaf is just a name that we impose on it. And it was like, yes, I found something. Yeah, this was so good. And then, you know, Buddhist tradition, Shantideva, you know, when is and isn't are both absent from your mind, there's nothing left for mind to do but rest in perfect peace from concepts free. It's not just rational concepts, it's much deeper. So, partly that explains the very complicated ninth chapter of the Bodhicaryavatara. So fascination with the shifting of experience, shifting according to your perspective, and then noticing that we're creating it. Yeah. So this is just me self. Nothing less than Buddhism would do for this. A love of image, a love of beauty. Dukkha doesn't do it for me. I mean, it's great, it's true, and I'll focus on it, but it won't shift me. If I'm ill, Dasty has to feed me drugs. I'll just sit there like an old cow or something. You know, and she'll go, have you tried a Panadol? No, what? You know, I'll just sit with it, and it won't motivate me to move. But if I, something that I want, or something beautiful, you know, it'd be a beautiful idea, you know, a beautiful image, yeah, I'll get up and I'll walk 20 miles for it. I'll put the effort in. So when you have this image of this Pramasamvantara, the two practices, it's just like, yep, I'll do it, you know. But, you know, no amount of prodding, no amount of stick will make me move, I'll just be stubborn, you know. But a carrot, lovely, transcendental carrot, yep, off I go. Image, imagination, creating your experience, creating your world through all sorts of means. I had an interest all my life of magic. I was talking about voodoo on Sunday, and Alan Moore became a magician. I'm quoting Yeats further on, he's also a magician, in which you can, through imagery and through word, or spells actually, spells is creating language to create a world. You know, you create a universe, you change the world you're in. Maitre Nagy was talking about mantra. Through those words, you are reshaping the very fabric of what you're standing on, who you are, and your whole perspective. That gets me interested. Metaphor. So you're talking about that. We're in the world of metaphor, in which something refers to something else. We'll come back to that. Hopefully, we'll get time to come back to that. But basically, something I like to say somewhere, that metaphor is important, because it hints and it points to something important about the structure of reality. If you look at a literal word, that's it. What does that mean? It means this. End of story. A metaphor points beyond itself. A bit like the evolutionary psychologists always try to find what makes humans unique, and they keep having to discover something new and discover that animals do something. But I heard somewhere, at the moment, children get to a certain age that chimpanzees don't get to the point. The hand is pointing to something beyond itself. A metaphor is pointing beyond itself. You know, I wandered lonely as a cloud. Literally, it's gibberish. You're not a cloud. You're not even like a cloud. But what a cloud does, evokes something by pointing beyond the word into a whole sense of wandering, lonely, cloud. Yeah. So, icon. A religious icon is, these do not look like these figures. They're not portraits. Yeah. They're more important than that. They are that. They stand as a doorway into that greater reality. It's a whole different way of looking at art. And then, important thing around this is that we create our world, and and by the awareness you bring into your experience, you notice that. You notice that what you're relating to isn't objectively, solidly real, but is a representation. You are creating that. You're making that up to relate to. So you're being creative all the time. You are making up things all the time. You're making up the world. Whether you call them neurons or gods or yidams or everything, we as a human construction is an artistic creative response to reality. And it's constantly changing and evolving within that, those constructions. It's like the bishop has woken up and taken to be able to choose his mask. Yeah. The bishop, the Puritan, the one image, the one perspective you're locked in, you start to say, hang on, I can change this. So all of this really got me in. This is like years later, opening into sadhana and exploring this. But sort of this was the orientation that meant that when I first took up, was given sadhana, then I was able to, I really took it, and it all made sense. Everything else made sense. To sit and do sadhana, I have to be in a positive, focused state. I have to be aware of my body. You do sadhana with your body as much as with your. You're not doing it. What was it, Alka? One of my mentors said, it's not like a viewfinder and you're slotting in postcards in the front of your, bit of your brain. That's not the game. It is like, just as much as I was breathing, I have a body, and the figure, either in you, and you've got Avalokiteshvara here, Amitabha out there, or the figure there is you relating to another body, the way that we're doing right now. We're our basic metaphors, one of our basic creative roots is having a physical presence and being aware of another physical presence. And the sadhana was given to me at ordination because it's a relation. It was given to me by my preceptor, who was personally knew me enough to witness my effect of going for a refuge and recognise that, and the sadhana was part of that. You can't get the sadhana off the internet. Yeah. It's not a technique. Yeah. So we've described these stages, but that's just the house for something which is a relation. I've got a body, I'm also a social being in relation to other social beings, and it's part of that. It's part of me being part of the tree right in the Buddhist order. So the sadhana is, it's not literally sad, it's not like you're passing down things written on a piece of paper. That's just a way of holding it and making it work. But it's something is a spirit, something's passed down through your teachers, down through to you. And then the day you become a private precept, you're passing on that spirit. Not just handing them a sheet of paper with the answers on it. It's not a literal thing, it's an oral tradition, it's not a written poem. Imagine if we sat here and read a Yeats poem. Every time we read it, it came out differently because it came from the Yeats within us. All we had to do was turn into Yeats. And then every poem we did would be as good as Yeats and different every time. Yeah. Get that? In some cultures, that's what poetry is like. Yeah. They're as alive as Africa, maybe. Yeah, I know. So it's part of a living community. And my perspective is interesting. We've come to a meeting, similar point. My perspective is I've always been very religious. I always say that I spent a gap year in the secular world between ceasing to believe in God and becoming a Buddhist. So it was theistic with a definite sense of something invisible. The minister today in the church at my uncle's funeral was talking about there's a visible world and an invisible world. And it's beautiful. Classical Greek philosophy merged with Christianity, so it's all this stuff, and so there always was that. So people think being aware of a presence, I've always had that. It's just changed its religion. So that sense, and I had a psychedelic gap year, and then I became Buddhist. So it's like, so the normal secular frameworks, materialism or egalitarianism, all these things, are a bit strange to me. But it's another culture. I've not spent too long in it. I have to understand it because I'm talking to other people in that culture. That's fair. Pamasamva and Tara, they're like personalities in my life. I've got all these friends I know, people I know, and Pamasamva and Tara are major figures in my life. You know, who do I know? Who's my pals? Dun 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 dun. And both them too as well. One thing I'll end in a bit, which is what has happened over the years. So I took up, was given Pamasanava practice 24 years ago at my ordination, and then 6 years after that, Pamasanava and Tara were always there as a pair. There's something about the two of them together. You often see them in pictures together. I just couldn't choose, and I thought, right, you need to get a bit more ballsy and active. So Pamasanava's your man for the first 6 years, and then we'll do it for 3 years, and then we'll see where we're at. 6 years later, I was going to take up Tara, so I took up Tara as well. And I alternate them. So in the waxing moon, it's Pamasanava, and the waning moon, it's Tara. Over the years, it's kind of moved from kind of getting it right or having an experience in a bit of a narrow way to a breadth of being in the ambience or the environment of Pamasanava and Tara. And that leaks out, so it's outside sitting practice as well, so that I'm in the world of Pamasanava, in the world of Tara, I can do the mantra. I've got my mala, which I'm always clicking away at quiet moments, so even watching telly sometimes. It's a sort of steady low presence of content. And if you add on these extra counters, your mala goes up to not 11 but a million. The Spinal Tap, the amp goes up to 11. This goes up to a million. So it's kind of like such a huge number that you can't hardly do. It's more than you. And you just kind of fall into that environment and let them do that. It's like relaxing. It's like most practices can go this way. It's not getting lazy and soft, but you're relaxing into the ambience. Mindful of breathing, you are just carried by the breath. Yeah, that goes deeper and deeper and more and more. In metta, the metta is doing you sometimes, and that becomes stronger and stronger. Bhante, in the days, there was a phase, the order's always good, it's phases, and people were talking about Buddha nature, and he said in a comment, it might be more helpful rather to think of Buddha nature being in me, to think of me being in Buddha nature. And I just went, oh yes, it's the religious upbringing, the religious perspective. And also turning to them in need, yeah, turning to them in prayer. It's like it's good to have a range of deities. So there's the lower ones, like whether Norse or Voodoo or something. It just can do ordinary mundane things and sort of orientate towards them. There's also other ones which are just beyond. They won't play the game. They're not interested in catching the bus. Tara and Pamasanava, it's not interested in catching the bus in time. They're very interested in the state of mind when you miss the bus. Yeah. Thor or somebody, he wants you to get the bus, you know, get in there, you know, whatever. You're creative working with this images and context. Yeah. Of course, at this funeral today, it's Scottish farmers, so they've got to the 23rd salmon every time, you know. So, yes, though I walk in death's dark veil, yet shall I fear none ill, for thou art with me, and thy rod and staff me comfort still. So that's the salmon, that's the big grim Abrahamic Jehovah, isn't it? So the difference between that and Pamasanava and Tara is this emptiness appearance, this creative dimension. But that's as real and valid as a psychological interpretation of a language, or a modern secular language for Sadhana, to use that side. Yeah, more the kitten side, that what grows. We were talking earlier in the week about self-power is a baby monkey. It clings on the back of its mother and is carried, but is holding on by itself. And you get temperaments like that. Temperaments from the day you're born. That's that temperament. And other ones that go, carry me. A kitten gets carried by the mother. So this is more kitten practice. So it's got faith and devotion side as a valid part of the path. We'll come back to that in our next round. One thing is, with descriptions, it's always a bit tentative because you're in an area where descriptions just melt, sink into the water, dissolve, you know, they kind of don't hold in this area. It's like a relationship with a person in that you're always surprised. A good relationship, you don't know what's going to come next, you know, they'll surprise you all the time. And different people have different ways of engaging. Some people have very sort of visual sides, and other people not so much. I don't normally have surprises. I had one retreat that really surprised me. I was on the private precepts retreat, and we're doing what's known as the bodhicitta practice, in which all you're doing is exchanging all of the poisons and evil of the world for your own positivity. That's all you're doing. I thought, you're joking, I'm doing that? You know, it's just so enormous. But you've got the help of your going for refuge, your ideal you hold of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, above your head, coming into your heart. So I had Padmasambhava wind in my heart, and he's sitting in there quite happily, you know. And I'm having a go at this exchanging gunk, sort of the gunk that you find in dried up rivers in India. It's the most evil, black, sticky stuff you could ever see. And I grew up on the farm, so this is much worse. So it's coming in and it's flowing out. And I looked down, it was like I was looking down, metaphorically, in a way. And Padmasambhava had his sleeves rolled up and had a basin of soapy water in front of him, and he was scrubbing metal shrine bowls, you know, like those brass things. I think it was sparked off, but the day before I left for that retreat, Dana Badri was doing the very same thing in the flower sink, scrubbing those little shiny brass bowls. Day one, they were brass, and they changed to silver, and day two, they were gold. But this, there he is, just, and it's just like, I could never have thought that up in the month of Sundays, where this came from. It's like, here's Padmasambhava's role at the season, scrubbing away, cleaning, making shiny these shrine bowls, which, you know, is the world and the symbol.
I'm just thinking about positive emotion again. When I reflect about change and anatta, there's a tendency in us to think that we are the centre of change, that we are the axle of the whole universe. Everything revolves around us. Now that's not what the mind, I don't think, that's what mind first doctrine says. I think that the very notion of us, you know, like when Suryavamsa was saying, you are creating, that he was creating whatever, imaginative things. The emptiness, the maya that we're bringing to that is that that creator is empty as well. Yeah. Mm. So we need to be quite explicit about that. But then we get into areas of great fear. That's scary. That's really serious stuff. That is like, whoa. And I had an experience of fear, great fear in meditation. And I presume it was this fear of this idea of spiritual death. You know, that you were just not able to hold that idea of not being in control or not being there even. I'm not saying you wouldn't be there, but I'm talking about the fear I held. And that's why we need the spiritual. We must, you know, the metta is a big thing that allows you to hold that and to move into that terrain and to do all this dancing in there. So I think that's, for me, is very important. And that's where the practice takes the edge and the insight reflections for me, because, you know, otherwise it's just egotistic fancifulness.
Yeah.
You know, you're just disappearing up your own delusions. Yeah. I think we've been going on for an hour. I think that's probably enough, actually. I think, looking at people. Are you wanting to take one or two questions, if there are any there?
Good. I've got a couple of quotes.
Right.
Explains
quotes.
It all. Yeah.
Great.
I was looking up Yeats before I came along. There was one quote I was looking for, because you find three more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Something about why is a human form? Because you are a human being. Yeah. So it's not, you brought a lovely deeper angle into it. It's not like I am making it. It's not like a human thing. I am the centre of everything, or the human is the centre of it. It's like that creation goes both ways. Yeah, so everything breaks up into that emptiness. But there's something about the perceptual situation. You notice that Buddhism never leaves the perceptual situation, never leaves, and it's not it's not the precipitation, but lots of little tiny ones, you know, ever changing. So it never creates this hard objectivity. Yeah, so it always focuses on, in modern terminology, experience. And we are human beings, so we're doing this, the sadhana, we're entering into relation with another human being. And as I was saying before, we can do it to the degree that we're aware of ourselves sitting here. The raw material, like if you're a sculptor, the raw material can be clay. The raw material in the sadhana is your awareness of your body and your awareness of another being. That basic social, neurologists talk about mirroring, don't they? So there's a basic ability to be aware of another human being. That meta is that, is you're moving into empathy for another, so you're one with them. So it's a human thing, and it's embodied. In the depths of your meditation, you're always embodied, but you might be of light. Sometimes in deep meditation, it's where the breath becomes really refined. It's not always your chunky and solid or feeling that. So that one of the 8 quotes is, how can we know the dancer from the dance? So what we can tend to do is try to abstract Buddhism, try to abstract these into techniques rather than, you know, you're the dancer, you cannot separate the dancer. At the end of his life, he said, we can only conceive those thoughts which we have conceived, not in the brain, but in the whole body. Which is why you have to do the previous practices a lot. You have to integrate, become present, become aware, and you have to have this, you're talking about positive emotion. In the figure, you'll see some of the little statues, there's flowers and jewels. And it's kind of like what positive emotion looks like as a picture. It's, you know, it's not like this muddy, plain, just any old thing thrown over, a baggy old t-shirt will do. You know, it's like, it's beautiful because that's the expression of positive emotion. And I was thinking, finally, I was talking about Leonard Cohen on Sunday. Leonard Cohen had a Jewish funeral. Buddhists always try to appropriate people who get involved in Buddhist things. Go, Leonard Cohen's a Buddhist now, and it's like he stayed Jewish, and especially at the end of his life, again, he was regularly went to synagogue and stayed Jewish. And I was thinking about a woman who wrote in Tricycle about attending funerals of her generation of baby boomers who got into Buddhism were dying off, and she's lost count a number of times that. She went to funerals of her fellow Dharma teachers, and it was Christian or it was Jewish, or, you know. And it's kind of like how to our Dharma. It's fair enough, choices you make, but if you want your Dharma to sort of really go deep and become go for refuge at depths of our heart, what does it take to stay Buddhist in moments of crisis? It's not just a therapy or a well-being technique or a means to be happy in a normal secular or psychological level. How can we take it so that it goes deeper than that? I have 2 friends in chapters who, at moments of crisis, one case getting isolated, particularly the temperament helped, and another case, his mother dying, who went through a process and they ended up back in their case as a Catholic Church. And it's... how does it go deep? It has to go deep enough by broadening out, by becoming something deeply devotional and deeply engaging. Yeah. So I think for me, the sadhana is something that kind of is a way in. We've all got our ways in. But it's if we're meditating with a conscious top half and maybe a bit rational or a bit therapeutic or a bit just to sort out our lives in this moment, you know, in a measured way. Or is it something that's passion that can move the very depths? You know? For me, it's like sadhana brings in that side. Yeats' final quote: "The only 2 powers that trouble the deeps are religion and love. The others make a little trouble on the surface." We spent a few minutes on the how the what this has got to do with people who aren't. Doing sadness,
I'm concerned about people's well-being.
How are you doing?
Fine.
Okay. Ish. I've got a great quote from him. What's that woman? Is it Armstrong, the nun?
Carrie Armstrong.
That's amazing. It's too long to read. It's great.
What's the gist of it?
But just a bit, it's just what Yeats said very briefly there, is that throughout centuries, people have been wanting to continue and to generalise the glimpses we get when we look at nature, in discussion with others, just the glimpses of things, we want to generalise it into all our daily activities. And that goes into religions. We don't always get it right, but when it does go right, it's that holding the glimpse of things, holding it dearly. Because I think she's a very wise woman, you know. So what do you do with all this stuff? What's to be done? You've obviously heard that it means something to us. And most people that I know who do it, not all ordinary members do sadhana practice. It doesn't land on everybody like that. But they all, I would imagine, hold some idea of the transcendental object. You know, they hold that there. I think the way to get the things that help are the things that we're doing, actually. I think not being too worried. This is my Trinada, Naga speaking here. There's nobody else, right? There's no authority except for my experience. I think fleeing suffering is no solution. Right? I really don't think that helps. I think just getting on with things is in that good old Scottish way, but not ignoring suffering is very, very important. I think doing things which are not to do with us is very, very important. I think rolling up to do the flowers or to do whatever it is you do at the centre, to come and participate in classes, to come and take classes, to come and do work, whatever that is, the work of the Dharma, that is very useful for yourself and for others. Okay? And the duality of that will start to break down. You just go on with it. Okay? I have a personal, you maybe have heard this already, I think metta's quite important. I think metta and generosity are the two things. I mean, the Buddha said that. This is now authority speaking. Okay, the big man. If you practice metta bhavana and generosity, you will be happy. It's dead clear. And I bang on about that all the time, but it's that's not rocket science. It's sometimes quite hard to do properly, real giving. But metta and generosity, that's the way forward, because that makes you slacker and looser. Makes you more, I've got words written down for this somewhere, but I can't remember what they are. It makes you less bounded. Pliant. Mudu is the word, the lovely word in Pali, mudu. But it makes you more, less self-obsessed, really. As simple as that. You know, just you realise that you are no more than a temporary conglomeration and an illusion of thought. And then you go, just do the metta at that very thought. But that's where it goes. I think puja is an amazing approximation. What, you got a word for that? What is this?
What's word?
Something about practices that approach.
Prefigurations. Yeah, I think it's theological, isn't it? Like Isaiah prefigures Jesus, but you get just, it's like sadhana doesn't just start the day you get your sadhana private ordination. Got a long tail, and we're all doing it. We all turn up and go, I don't know, some of us love this statue, some of us hate it. So maybe it's not the best example, but it's just like there's something you see, you go, that's it, that's what I want. And it doesn't have to be an image, it can be something, you know, a teaching of the Dharma can be an icon or an image into this catching, holding something deeper, like a verse, yeah, something Dharma, a verse. A mantra sometimes that catches us, you know, but something that just like we tend to, and people I know, like Donnie, does reception on what day is he in? Tuesday. And it's like you see him working away doing reception stuff in the office, and this wee sound that's coming from his tablet, of a Tara mantra, a Tara tune, just going over and over and over. That's the start of it. Or people I know, like Lindsay or Bill, get into Akshobhya. You know, you collect the, we collect postcards. Something makes a significance. A Vajra. Yeah. Look at this tropical star. It's something fascinating. It starts to draw it. It's the little golden thread that Blake talks about. It leads you in through Jerusalem's door. Is it Jerusalem's gate? And start one of his poems. So it's just that it's tending to those, you know, and whatever it catches you, it's like, if it's, in a way, I remember reading about, it's the story of Pamasamba's time, the practice you took up was the one where your flower landed when you threw it on a sand mandala that they made in this temple. So it's kind of like, we've got all these biases, and reality has got nothing to do with these biases, so why not just pick any random, you know, spin the wheel. Imagine your ordination would be a tombola stall with a mind you, Shri. It would just be as good, but this is a kind of practice where you're working with the momentum that's already running. You're using that, you know, if you're up and running and got an orientation, use that, throw that in. It's how you meditate as well, isn't it? So I was keeping it really simple, staying objective, staying open. It's like using every part of your orientation and your inclinations and steering it towards the Dharma. It's quite a Pamasamba thing. So you take all your troubles on the path, yeah? All your struggles, you know, and things that are drawing to us are those that speak the most to all that about us. So that's why it's relevant, and it catches what we're talking about, the form and emptiness and an ideal and metaphors and things. It's pointing to a wider reality about the Dharma. It's not just about sitting down and doing sadhana. You know, as a preceptor, I could I can make a good joke, I think, of, I haven't tried it yet, but somebody goes, I don't like wee folk on flowers in the sky, what's it got to do with anything? And they really take to the mindfulness of breathing. You can see it really moves them, and in that mindfulness of breathing they are moving from the depth, something bigger shining through. I could do that. I'd practice for ages, work out something. I've got the resources, not just me, the whole order. There's people, you know, Damarati's one of them, Satcha, Raja, people that could are really good at that practice and do it in a full way. And we could come up with something that would work, you know. So it doesn't have to look like the postcards. It doesn't have to be an image, but it has to hold something. Even the word transcendental can be limited, can't it? But something that of that beyond, something of that beyond ourselves, we're talking about Dharma Nyima, something that holds, it's that experience beyond experience, and it's got something of the Buddha in it.
Do you think there's a place for no, I understand what you're saying, we can perform sadhana in many different varieties of way, but is there a place for just taking a given practice and vivifying it with our own practice, just making it, working with it.
Yeah. But if you still get stuck, though.
If you still get stuck.
It's always a case of meditation. Do the standard thing. Really try it out. Don't decide beforehand you're going to have problems with it, because that's just you imposing something on the experience.
Yeah, yeah.
If the problems arise, deal with it. There's innumerable ways of working with it. Anyone that can work in the meditation, teach meditation, will be able to help you with it. Count to five rather than ten. But don't say at the start, I don't like count to ten, it's going to be a problem. Come to that conclusion 6 months in. Yeah, so it's like that with sadhana.
I think there's a problem. There was not a problem. I think sometimes I do sadhana as a shamatha practice, and sometimes it's just a positive emotion practice.
It fills up from the bottom.
You know, it fills up from the bottom.
So
it's not all quite. The glory is sort of varying degrees. I think we should do some puja tonight.
Yeah.
In
the spirit of everything we've been gathering about.
Yeah, I know. Experience the glory in different degrees. I think that's us. We'll be 5 minutes. Or straight in.
5 minutes, people.
Five minutes.
Because they get flatter and flatter.